I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
No, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
On the 25th of July 2004, Brian Blackwell murdered his elderly parents with what was described as breathtaking callousness in the safety, the sanctuary of their own home, a place where they should have felt safer than ever. He then embarked on a luxury three-week holiday with his girlfriend. He didn't even attempt to cover his tracks, believing that he would somehow be able to evade and escape justice. But as is so common in these cases, he was very, very wrong. This is the horrific case of Brian Blackwell. I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Let's talk about Brian Blackwell. He's an unusual character. Let's make that clear from the get-go. So he was born in 1986. He lived in a place called Melling, which is Merseyside. It's not too far from where I live. It's about 50 minutes away from my home in Greater Manchester. And it's a really nice area. It's quiet. It's leafy. It's very affluent. So we're talking about the middle classes. It's as simple as that. Now, his father, a man called Sidney Blackwell, but he's known as Brian, he was 72. And he was a retired accountant. He's actually nicknamed Big Brian. So immediately we can conjure up images of an individual who's obviously quite a big guy, but also has a big heart. You know, he's a good person, a reliable person, a sage to some degree. His mother was Jacqueline Blackwell. She was 61 and she was actually a former antiques dealer. We're talking about very bright, intellectual, successful individuals. And they were described as being a really pleasant couple. They were very much keeping themselves to themselves in their retirement. So they're going about their business under the radar, just living family life. Brian Sr. and Jacqueline were actually in their mid-50s, late 40s, respectively, when Blackwell was actually born. So they're older parents, as I am to my baby daughter. One of the things about them is they were notably said to be very overprotective. And apparently they did seek to try to really control a lot of Blackwell's experiences, behaviours and aspects of his life from when he was a very young child. Now, when you were an older parent, particularly back in the 80s when he was born, I understand that part of this may have felt very challenging for a child growing up, because one of the things about the 80s and early 90s is it's a time of change and transition in the UK. You know, you've got the whole Manchester situation with big Manchester bands coming out. You've got this more fluid experience societally. The drug era is still going strong. You've got warehouse parties, clubbing opportunities, and a real transition, I think, from the 60s and 70s. And lots of young people growing up at that time in the 80s and 90s, you wanted this freedom. You felt that there were things out there that you just wanted to experience. And if you had older parents who'd grown up at a time where morals and ethics were different, and parenting was certainly different because you were parented by older parents from different generations, then your child's peers' parents would have been in, therefore your parenting would be different. For that child, it could be quite frustrating. I will acknowledge that. But also, we're talking about people who had very strong boundaries. They knew what they wanted for their child. They wanted the best for him. He was obviously somebody that they relished having because they hadn't had children until this point. He would no doubt have been considered an absolute gift. And to some degree, they're at a point in their life where they can really smother him with their love and smother him with their expectations. And that can be positive and negative in equal measure. He was somebody who did excel. Now, like I said, both the parents are probably quite academic themselves. So on a pure genetic level, he probably is quite lucky because they are bright people themselves. But he's an all-rounder. He's really athletic. He was actually a member of his local tennis club, and he'd actually been an under-18s tennis champion there. So he's very good at standing out. And for the most part of his very early childhood, for the right reasons. He was also academically gifted. And he really was academically gifted. We're talking about somebody who scored top in all of his exams, somebody who didn't necessarily need to work too hard to succeed academically. And again, when you are bringing up a child who is very gifted, even if you're bright, that can be challenging because, first of all, they want to know psychologically about the world in a different way than most of their peers do because they're asking questions, they're intrigued and curious on a higher level because of the fact that they just are more progressed on a mental level academically than people should be of their age. You know, we have a typical level of intellect, about 100 IQ is a typical intellect. And bear in mind, as a normal, average, typical human being with an intellect of 100, you are really bright. I think people underestimate their intelligence as humans all the time. So you're bright anyway. But anything above that, that means that the world is going to have different shades and colours than it would do to the peers that you're growing up with. And that can come with a whole host of pressures, both for the parents and indeed for the child. Now, he was nicknamed Little Brian by his parents, and his friends actually used to call him Brains, which is understandable because he was super bright, and clearly it was a play on the fact that his name is indeed Brian. He was described as an exemplary student. Everyone thought he was fantastic in his education. He got a scholarship to Liverpool College. That was one of the best schools in Merseyside. It actually cost £7,000 a term. It's not a private school, I don't think, any longer. But understandably, there's a huge amount of money being invested into Brian because, firstly, he's got the talent, he's got the capabilities and capacities, and also his parents are in a position where they can really indulge him because they're in a financially sound state and they have quite a lot of time as well. And again, that plays positively and negatively into the picture. We all know how powerful and pivotal it is, in fact, to have parents involved in our lives. If you have loving parents who are present at all the plays that you do, at all your school musicals, all the opportunities to attend school for the extracurricular activities, your sports and so on and so forth, that's going to reinforce how much they love you. Equally, it can feel really, really suffocating. And we also have to acknowledge that they were older. Like I said, I'm an older parent, so I feel like I'm able to comment in this way. And when you are older, and you might have parents around you who are 20 years younger, your kid's gonna notice that. So he may also struggle just with the appearances of his parents. I'm not saying ultimately that that's the case. I'm saying it could be a propellant in some of the feelings that he might have negatively towards his parents. Now, Blackwell, because he is so bright, because he's done so exceptionally well at school, he's planning to study medicine and he was going to go to the University of Nottingham in September 2004. It's a beautiful university. It's quite spectacular, particularly on the sciences level. And his parents really just hoped that he'd become a surgeon. He wanted to be a doctor, definitely, but she, as a mother, was constantly saying to him, you know, I want you to be a surgeon. I don't just want you to go and study medicine and become a GP. I want you to go ahead and go really as far as you can to that consultant level. And apparently his mother, Jacqueline, was always bragging about this to her neighbours. So clearly, both the parents idolise him and genuinely feel that he can be anything that he wants to be. But even when he's talking about going and studying medicine, they're not thinking ultimately about the amazing achievement of passing a medical degree. They're thinking, no, it's got to go past that. He's got to reach the very pinnacle of his academic prowess and also his professional prowess. And of course, when it comes down to the medical world, being a consultant, certainly going from doctor to mister, as it is in the UK, is going to present that for you. And for Jacqueline being able to say to the neighbours, my son is going to just do so exceptionally well, I'm so proud of him, he's going to be a surgeon, that was something that held bragging rights for her. One of the things that he struggled with, however, was his social experience. So a lot of people who knew Blackwell said he was very socially inept. He was somebody that people struggled to warm to. And one of the reasons for that is he had apparently a very pronounced sense of self. So he came across as egotistical. He came across as somebody who didn't necessarily know how to communicate in a way that made people feel positively towards him. He did have friends, but this was something that stood out. It just felt a little bit off for the people around him. And he had a small circle of friends. A lot of people who got to know him in the wider circle of those friendship groups, though, were really put off by that ego. Because we all know how it feels, don't we? We've all ultimately been in groups of friends where an individual is somebody that we just can't connect with. That person who's always done it before you, you know, or done it better than you. How many times have you had that experience in your life? I mean, I've certainly had it when you'll say, oh, I've traveled to A, B, or C, you know, and you're just having a general conversation and another person that you don't really know who seems to always have an answer for everything chips in, that they haven't just been to those places, but like they've bought three homes there and, you know, they have staff. And on top of that, at the end of the day, they understand the historical and cultural context of that area so well because they're just so connected and so deeply involved and so on and so forth. And you know, a lot of the time people are just making those things up, but that's the kind of person and personality that we're talking about character-wise where this man is concerned. Now, when he gets to 18, a big thing happens for him. And bear in mind, at 18, we are developing into the person that we're going to become, but we're certainly not at ease with it, and we're certainly not who we're going to be in 15 years down the line. So at 18 versus 33, you are an entirely different human on the whole. But there is something very powerful of intimate relationships in our lives. So when you are 18 years of age, and like I said, you're finding out a little bit of who you are, what you like, what you don't like, where you want to go, all those insecurities that come with that, and then suddenly you have a love interest. It can be absolutely overwhelming. I think it's really easy to forget that as we get older and the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune hit us with the bills and the mortgage payments and the dealing with the day-to-day responsibilities. That is something beautiful, don't get me wrong, in a relationship when you can actually live with another human being and do all of those things that I've just said and still talk and like them at the end of the day. That's something really powerful. But when you're 18, there is not much aside from your educational experience and your social experience that really means that your time is taken up to any other degree than it would be if you were 15 years down the line and you're just like swamped with responsibility. So because of that, when somebody walks into your life and you feel those pangs of lust and attraction and intimacy, it capsizes so many of us. And for him, that's exactly what happens when Amal Saba walks into his life. You know, she just takes his breath away and they get together. And very quickly, that relationship becomes very intense. Essentially, she is Blackwell's first girlfriend, so the first love anyway. And she is somebody that just moves him profoundly. He wants her above everything else in his life. He wants her. He wants to impress her. He wants to provide her potentially with a lifestyle because he wants to make sure that she really connects with him. And it feels like this relationship sets fire to something within Blackwell. Now, Amal's parents were Jordanian doctors and they actually lived in a nearby suburb in Liverpool. So you can imagine a young man who wants to be in medicine himself, that's going to be something that he's very impressed with as well, because these are clearly successful people who followed a career path that he himself wants to follow. So he wants to impress her, he wants to improve them as well. And again, very middle-class experience, you know, very much peers when it comes down to his own parents. And to all intents and purposes, this should be brilliant because he's met a girl who his parents will consider an equal with parents who they will consider equals. This could get off to an excellent start, but I wouldn't be covering this case in this video if that's how it was going to go. Because the problem for this young man is that he cannot speak the truth. He just cannot do it. He is one of those compulsive liars that cannot help himself to some degree. I'm not saying he's pathologically a compulsive liar. I'm saying that at 18 years of age, he's so desperate to impress people that he really doesn't care whether he's spinning a yarn or whether he's telling the truth. It's whatever suits in the moment. And also the impulse control of him being able to contain himself in these moments just is impossible for him. If he needs to prove something or needs to suggest that he's better than A, B, or C, he has to do it. And we'll talk about narcissism a little bit later on. But I will say at this moment in time, when we talk about true narcissists are individuals who psychologically have this deep inferiority complex within them. And they know it's there and they hate it and they do everything to avoid confronting that. And one of the ways that you can do that is to weave a fantasy of lies around you, believing that if you convince everybody else about who you are, then maybe you can see their reflection of you and start to believe it for yourself. Now, in the months leading up to July 2004, he has been constructing what can only be described as an incredibly elaborate web of lies, and they are very elaborate. The energy that he put into lying is enormous. Again, he's a high achiever, he's very academic, he's very manipulative, and because of his intelligence, he understands certain capabilities that can essentially fool people into believing what he's telling them. Now, he'd always exaggerated his achievements from day one, but it's almost like this goes on steroids after he begins his relationship with Amal. Now, bear in mind, part of that is because he wants to impress her. Without a doubt, I can look back at when I was 17 and 18 and see that I exaggerated things. I wanted to seem cool. I wanted to seem in with the crowd. I wanted to be interesting. And actually, my life wasn't that interesting, right? So if I could embellish a little bit my experiences to make them seem more exciting for others, I would do that. It's something that certainly I dropped when I hit my 20s, but I remember those moments and I think we can all relate to those circumstances. And you didn't even feel that you were lying. You just felt that you were adding something to the story to make it seem more interesting because you didn't feel that interesting. You felt insecure about yourself. And I remember so many of my friends doing the same. And I completely empathize with him in that moment, wanting to seem like this standout guy to Amal. But he takes it to a whole new level. Now, bear in mind, he was an excellent tennis player. He wasn't Olympic standard, you know? He wasn't going to be in Wimbledon. But nonetheless, he was good. But it's not enough to be good. He doesn't want to just be good. He wants to be the best. And if he can't be the best by his own talent and gifts, then he'll pretend he's the best because that's something he is very good at, lying. He might not be as good at tennis, but he's certainly very proficient, I would say extremely proficient for his age in manipulation and lying. So he starts to lie more and more about how great he is. It's not enough to say I'm just brilliant at this lawn tennis and I've done really well in my age group. No, he now tells her that he's been sponsored by Nike. And you can imagine, can't you? I mean, Nike is just a huge company. You get a sponsorship by them and you are quids in. They don't go and sponsor small fries. They're the kind of people that sponsor LeBron James, for example. They're the individuals who can make you a multimillionaire overnight. It's what everybody dreams of. But this is what he tells her. He's sponsored by them, and he even goes as far as forging a lawn tennis association ranking. So he puts himself at the very top of the junior rankings. Now, he's actually only a county club player, so he's a good player, but no, puts himself right at the top of those junior rankings. He wants to see his name there, even though he knows he's faked it. By putting it there, psychologically, he allows himself to believe that maybe that's true. Maybe if she believes it, then he can believe it. Then he starts to spend the money and he spends a fortune on Amal. Bear in mind, he's a student. He doesn't have money of his own and yet is buying her jewelry. Said that it was really expensive jewelry. Now, it turns out that that jewelry is fake, but the reason that it's fake is he doesn't have an income. So even though he's going out and getting this fake jewelry where the diamonds aren't real, it's still money he can't afford to be spending. And actually, for any 18-year-old girl, if a boyfriend turns up and gives you cubic zirconia ring, fake crystal rings, you don't care. You're just blown away that this guy that you're dating, who's treating you like you are a princess, is going out of their way to provide you with something that's beautiful, albeit inexpensive. But that's not enough for him. He wants her to believe and buy into this idea that he's literally buying her diamonds and pearls. And he goes even further. So he buys her a Ford car. basically had a £10,000 bond that his parents had set aside for his university education. You know, they're diligent parents. They know it costs money to send people to be educated. They want him to get the best education. They've gone out of their way to do that. But he just takes it, spends it, albeit on a car for her. But this is because he wants to impress her. And he took Amal for a test drive also in a $60,000 Mercedes. Bear in mind, Blackwell couldn't actually drive at the time. So he had to get the salesperson to drive them round. It was less a test drive. It was more a taxi ride. But can you imagine the brass you have to carry this kind of ruse through? To actually go to a posh car showroom and to get that sales rep to believe that you, who's 18 years of age, are actually in a position where you can spend £60,000 on a car and to kind of get away with it to a point where they take you for a ride, even though you cannot drive. So he's upping the ante constantly. Look at me, look what I can do. And that's what I'm talking about, because often we hear the word narcissism and we imagine this person with this inflated ego who's superior and arrogant. And certainly those traits exist, but it's on top of this deep inferiority. And what I'm describing here is an individual with that understanding, that sense of their inferiority, going out of their way to layer by layer try to disguise it by these kind of actions. Now, he actually goes on to tell Amal that he'd bought that car and, quote, he'd parked it in his £400,000 luxury flat in Southport. So basically, now he's got £450,000 flat. And he said, it's actually a flat in the same flat building, same set of apartments where Stephen Gerrard lives. Now, Stephen Gerrard is very, very famous footballer in the UK. So again, this layer upon layer of lies, and lies to some degree that would be easily found out down the line. Because I don't know about you guys, I'm just going to throw it out there. My boyfriend, who just bought me a car, was like, you know what? I've got this luxury flat. It's a £450,000 flat. Same set of apartments as Stephen Gerrard. I'd be like, let's go there now, you know, immediately. Because that's a big deal. And bear in mind, this is a good few years ago now. And that's when £450,000 was probably the equivalent of £1 million. So you would expect something pretty iconic. And then he goes even further. So he offers Amal a job as his manager. I mean, that would have been one easy job. The only thing he'd have had to manage was the lies he was telling people. But aside from that, I don't think there'd have been a lot of work involved. But he goes ahead and he actually gives her a contract. He says, I'm going to get this contract. I'm going to get it underwritten by Nike. And you're going to get £80,000 a year plus expenses. Now, I'm just going to throw it out there. I would have accepted that job immediately. I wouldn't have cared what job I was doing. The idea of just managing my boyfriend for £80,000 a year and getting expenses on top of that, I'd have been eating at some very nice restaurants and staying at some very nice hotels, all on him, as opposed to the Holiday Inn or the Premier Inn, which is the ones that I tend to stay in the UK. Also, he went ahead and wrote her a cheque for £39,000 because he wanted to kind of prove that there was a down payment. Now, surprisingly, it bounced, you know? I mean, she must have been stunned. This guy, £450,000 flat, massively expensive car, after buying her a car, you would be putting that in thinking, brilliant, £39,000, what am I going to do with that? It's more money than I've ever seen. But for her, it will have been surprising when it bounced. But for us, we understand fully, of course it did. He doesn't actually have any funds in his bank account. But she is 100% under his spell. She really believes this guy is somebody who has an excessive amount of money and someone who is going to make her life absolutely beautiful. She's 18. Of course she's going to feel like that. It's like the Princess Diaries. All your dreams have come true. Now, you don't have to be Agatha Christie, Sherlock Holmes, or Columbo to realise it's not going to end well, is it? He can't sustain this lifestyle. He wants to impress his girlfriend. He wants to provide her with this incredible life that she's enjoying. Of course she is. But it's going to be stressing him out. And what we know about stress, it is one of the biggest triggers for violence. It genuinely is. It's one of the reasons why predators are so dangerous when they have additional stresses placed in their life, because they are violent anyway, and this exacerbates that violence. But even if you have not been too violent in your life, when you find yourself in very stressful and frustrating situations, it can make you act in a very hostile manner. And certainly, I think this is very much the motivation that leads to what we're talking about today. So he goes ahead, because he's desperate to keep going with this ruse that he's rich. He applies for 13 different credit cards. This is all in his father's name. He actually only received one, but that's bad enough that he attempts to get all of these cards and still does manage to get one. So now he's fraudulent, and we know that his father's going to find out about it at some point, because of course there's going to be repayments to make. He also attempts to get a cash advance from the bank. So basically he says, I'm a professional tennis player, I need the money because I'm going to play in the French Open. And he also wrote in his loan application that he would be able to repay the loan with a salary of £45,000 per year. So he's doing everything he can to prolong reality from setting in. You know, he knows it's coming for him. He knows that there's no way in the long term he'll be able to get away with that. But it doesn't matter. It's the moment that he's interested in. It's the moment-to-moment experience of being this person with this reputation, with his economic means. That's what's alluring for him. It's the spending time with Amal. It's being with her. It's walking around with his chest puffed out like he's the guy, he's the main man. That's what's feeding him. The ego and that inflated sense of self, because he's got this money at his fingertips in that moment, that's what's driving him. And that's how we end up at the fateful day. And that happens on the 25th of July, 2004. Now at this point, bear in mind, he's got no money, yet he manages to book two first-class tickets to New York. They're both booked on his father's credit card and they cost around £4,800. And again, what does that tell you? I mean, this is a guy who could just book two tickets to New York. It would still be fraudulent, but you're talking about a massively less cost when it comes down to two tickets at economy to go to New York. But it's not what he wants to do. He wants to present that he's this guy who's got these amazing means, and he wants to make sure that Amal feels that there's something amazing about him. And that's why he goes and books the first class tickets. And bear in mind, this is stage one in the 3-week luxury holiday across America that is planned. So he's going to go to America and the Caribbean. That's the plan. Now, a guy called Mike Keogh, so that's the former DCI, he actually was quoted as saying, my view is that Brian had now made a decision. There were two options open to him: tell his parents what he'd done and face humiliation with Amal, or carry out his intention to go to America using credit cards he'd managed to get through his father's bank account. And that's true. He could have just come clean. I've made some horrible errors. I've just made so many mistakes. I'm so sorry. Let's be real about this. His parents would be devastated. Of course they would. But they love him. They want what's best for him. They think he's incredibly motivated in his studies. They think that down the line, all of the work they've put in is going to pay off. And essentially, it would have been a horrible, embarrassing, shameful bump in the road. But it would have been a bump in the road that they could have got over together. But when he gets on that flight, it's almost like signing their death warrants. It's like there's no going back. He's decided on his course of action. He's pushing through with that course of action. And come what may, he is going to get what he wants, which is his life with Amal and, ideally, money. The day started out, I would say, in a fairly typical way. Brian went to play tennis. His father actually went with him. Like I said, these are very invested parents. Makes it even more tragic and devastating. Brian Senior at that point is chatting away to other people at the tennis club. Apparently, the conversations he had, the last conversations he had, the irony of this is he's talking about just how proud he is of his son, about how hard his son's worked for his A-levels, about how invested he is in his son's future. And then they go home together. There's nothing unusual going on. Just a father and his son hanging out whilst his son does an activity that he excels in, whilst his father just croons about what a great boy he is. Now, there is some discussion about whether Jacqueline and Brian Senior went out for dinner that evening, But what we do know is that somewhere in that time frame, Brian Blackwell's parents had found out about his credit cards and about the plane tickets that he'd bought that morning. So the house of cards crumbles. They all fall down. The domino effect begins. And he's confronted, not only with the recognition that now he has to explain himself, now he has to acknowledge a level of shame because of what he's done, now he has to fully come clean and admit the error of his ways. Yes, he's a gifted student. Yes, he's been somebody that the parents adore, but look at how he's fallen. And to admit that is something very challenging for him. But forget that. The other thing that plays in is he wants to be with his girlfriend. He's got plans. He doesn't want them thwarting his plans. He doesn't want them stopping him going away on his 3-week luxury trip. He doesn't want to not be on that first class plane ticket. He doesn't want that. He wants to be on that plane. He doesn't want to have to be confronted by the fact that everything that he's been doing has been in a fantasy. And now he's being confronted with the reality. So he picks up a hammer. It's a claw hammer, in fact. His father's just sat watching TV, unsuspecting. So just bear that in mind. They found out that he, without a shadow of a doubt, has been spending money fraudulently in his father's name. And yet his father isn't screaming at him. He isn't shouting at him. There isn't some kind of huge conflictual altercation in that moment. No. His father is in his armchair watching TV. At that point, Blackwell walks behind him and he smashes him in the head with a claw hammer. He'd have been completely unprepared. It was completely unprovoked. And he would have been blindsided in that moment and rendered completely helpless, understandably. After his mother hears the noise that feels very unusual, she'll be used to every single noise in her home. And when you hear something out of character, it just pricks your consciousness and you can't help but attend to it. So it's likely that after she hears a noise, maybe Brian Sr. gasping or shouting or falling to the ground, whatever it is, Blackwell's mother comes into the room to investigate. And for that, her son, the man who she has been cultivating to one day be this successful surgeon, hopefully, he pays her back by striking her with the hammer as well. Her last moments would have been spent in absolute shock as the child that she loved, the child that she bragged about, the child that she would have done anything for, took her life. I always think that when it's parents who are murdered by a child that they've brought up well, just that absolute shock that the person that they gave life to was taking their life from them. It's something that's so incompatible with what we imagine when we consider our children and the way that they feel about us. Now, after he has gone ahead and murdered both his parents, he basically disposes of his clothes in the garden and then he books a taxi to Amal's house. Now, the first taxi had turned up, but it had driven off because Blackwell hadn't come out of the house. Amal then understandably is thinking, where is he? So she gets in contact with him, asking where he is. Then a second taxi arrives and he goes to Amal's to spend the night. Police actually managed to track down the taxi driver who picked him up. And that taxi driver said, you know what? It's really hard to comprehend that he'd done anything because he was completely okay. He was totally complimentous. He wasn't upset. He was just totally typical as a customer. So immediately connecting us with this idea that after killing both his parents, he just seems to have no concern over it at all. Probably just thinking about what next. And the next is going on holiday with his girlfriend. So Blackwell and Amal, who's completely unsuspecting, bear that in mind, Amal has no idea she's going on holiday with a double murderer. They then go on that first class flight and on that holiday to America. And boy, that holiday was a holiday that I will never experience. And I imagine that many of you will not experience. There'll be somebody now watching going, actually, Emma, I only ever turn left when I'm going on long hauls. You know, I don't even know what that looks like. I think you'd get your own crockery. when you're in first class, don't you? I think they probably serve you a three-course meal that doesn't come in plastic. I don't know. I'm just throwing it out there. I believe some of them have bars and you can actually walk around. And I think you get beds. I really would like to go first class. It's never, ever going to happen. One, because it's highly expensive. And two, I'm a bit of a skinflint with money. I'd always think, well, I could go first class, or I could have another week somewhere beautiful instead, which will cost probably less. But after going first class and treating themselves to that, they go to the Plaza Hotel, where they've booked three nights in the presidential suite. I kid you not. The presidential suite. Now, I do know something about presidential suites. I've been in the media a long time and I filmed in presidential suites. I've just been allowed to go in and sit there whilst I film something, and then they've ushered me out until the paying people have arrived for their nice break. They are astonishing. And that's in hotels that are more average. You know, I've never been in five-star hotels with presidential suites. I dread to even think how incredible they'd be. I've seen them in the movies. Pretty Woman, I think he had one in that, Richard Gere. What I'm saying is, even an average presidential suite in like a four-star hotel is iconic. And in New York, I would imagine it is breathtaking. And I do not even want to conceive of the price, because we're talking ludicrous amounts of money. And of course, the Plaza Hotel in New York overlooks Central Park, which is just absolutely beautiful. They spent about £3,000. They drank champagne. They ate lobster. They ate truffles. So they are really living the high life. And you can imagine for a mile, she's a young person. You'd be looking at this man and thinking to yourself, you're 18. Look at you. Look at how incredible you are with your sponsorship by your sports brand and the fact that you care so deeply. You're buying me a car, you're giving me a job, you're giving me the most amazing journeys. You are going to think you have won the lottery 20 times over, because as well, on top of all the things I've just said, you're falling in love. So for her, this is going to feel like such a dream come true, and it feels real. Because she's eating the lobster and she's eating the truffles and she's drinking the champagne and she's in the presidential suite. Why wouldn't it be real? And then after doing that, they travel to Miami, to San Francisco, to Barbados. She is just completely captivated by this situation. Now, Blackwell spent a total of £30,000 on his father's credit cards. Also, at that point, he's reached a £1,500 overdraft because he's spent so much. Amal said that when she looked back on his behaviour during that incredible lifetime trip, she said it was upbeat. It was normal. So there was not a moment where she looked at him and thought, what's going on? He seems subdued, distant. He was just absolutely himself. She said she had absolutely no idea that he'd murdered his parents. She had no idea that back home, literally just around the corner from where her parents lived, there were two dead bodies left in their own home, rotting. For her, she's living her best life, ultimately not realizing that two other people had just lost theirs. Later, when she was interviewed by the police, she said, he was whining me, he was dying me all the time. He'd murdered his parents. They returned to England on the 12th of August, 2004. So at this point, it's going to get real, isn't it? Blackwell knows that the discovery of his parents will either have happened or will be about to happen. You could imagine that he's starting to feel a level of fear and stress. But again, this is a young man who's very good at living in fantasy. And as long as you can keep the fantasy going, well, you don't need to confront reality. So he doesn't go back to his parents. Of course he doesn't. He doesn't want to discover their bodies. He doesn't want to be the one to ring the alarm. He wants to have this fail-safe alibi. I've been out of the country. I couldn't have done anything. So he ends up staying with Amal and her parents. He actually says to them, look, I've been locked out of my own home, and that's because my parents are on holiday in Mallorca. I can't get in until they come home. So understandably, their daughter has just been on a three-week holiday of a lifetime. Of course they're going to let him stay at their home. Also, you're going to be like, this kid's got to marry my kid. I mean, like, I don't want to sound materialistic. I'm not a materialistic person. But let me tell you, my youngest son is single. If he just happened to walk in and be like, mum, yeah, look, this is Lady Asquith Montgomery's daughter, and she happens to be a oil tycoon's daughter too. I'd be like, oh, you know what? The thing about very quick romances and getting married within 6 weeks is I'm totally for them. And I think that she's the one, you know, because you just get it that your kid's going to have the most incredible life, you know? So I would totally allow somebody to come and live at my house for 2 weeks if they're just treating my child in such a way. I'd be like, I want you to stay forever. But maybe I could move into your home as opposed to vice versa, because I think yours is going to be nicer being an oil tycoon's billionaire daughter. She doesn't even exist, but you know where I'm going in my head. So he stays there for a fortnight. And this would ultimately be where things start going horribly wrong for him. Because bear in mind, he thought he was going to come home, find a crime scene. Also, he'd have this alibi because he was out of the country. But it turned out that nobody had visited the house. So he thought he was coming back. People would be like, oh, this terrible thing has happened. And nothing's changed. No one realises his parents are dead. He knows. But no one else does. So he has to come up with this idea of, all right, okay, I can't go to the house because if I go to the house, they'll figure out that I should have alerted the authorities that my parents are dead. I'm going to have to create this ruse that they're on holiday and hope that they believe that that was the case and I didn't go back because essentially I believe that my parents were away. Now, it's 1 week later that Blackwell gets his A-level results and he gets 4 A's. He gets maths, biology, chemistry and Spanish. He really is academically gifted. I mean, that is hard to get 4 A's in your A-levels. They are not easy exams at all. This meant, of course, that that dream of going to study for medicine was going to be something that actually happened. You know, he would have gone to that University of Nottingham. He would have started his course in medicine in the October of that year because he'd achieved his grades if he hadn't done what I'm talking about right now. Also, after he gets these results, which is clearly celebratory, Blackwell bumps into his head teacher, and apparently the head teacher said, listen, we had a really good conversation, we had a really lively discussion about how excellently he'd done, about how he was going to have this amazing career and this future as a doctor. So not showing even a sniff of grief, a sniff of fear, a sniff of coming to the conclusion that that dream being a doctor is never going to occur, because he's responsible for a double homicide. Now, the bodies do get discovered. He doesn't raise the alarm, but neighbours who initially haven't noticed that the Blackwell family have disappeared, and the reason for that is because the couple would often go to holiday to Spain on a regular basis. But then on the 5th of September 2004, a neighbour goes over to visit, and instantly they're hit with this really unpleasant smell. We all know what that is. It's a smell of decomposition. It is unmistakable. We are actually programmed as human beings to immediately recognize it, because if you smell that, it tends to forebode that something terrible has happened. It's meant to be a repellent to us. That's why we are so programmed to find it hugely distasteful, and they smell that. And then they open the letterbox. It's a very British thing to do. You have letterboxes in your house. If you think that somebody should be in, but they're not in, or they're not answering, and you're worried about them, you open, you shout the name through, it's just what we do in the UK. And when they do that, the instant thing they know is that there are flies buzzing about everywhere. And when you smell decomposition and you see flies, you know it's going to be a very, very bad outcome. That neighbour called the police immediately. They turn up quickly. And then, of course, they discover the bodies of both Jacqueline Blackwell and Brian Sr. And instantaneously, they can see that whatever caused them to die was a series of very serious injuries. So these aren't natural causes. That's immediately obvious. And Brian's body had actually become mummified, and Jacqueline's was actually putrefied. So you can just imagine what those first responders walked into. It would have been absolutely challenging beyond belief not to throw up on the spot. And I mean that genuinely, because when you are confronted with two bodies, one that's mummified, one that's putrefied, where there are flies everywhere and there is this repellent smell, it is going to turn the sturdiest of investigators' stomachs, without a doubt. Now, due to the state of the bodies, when the police actually looked at the couple, they thought they'd been shot. They couldn't figure it out. on first glance, it just seemed to be that it was more likely because of the entry wounds that they thought they could see that they'd actually been executed with a gun. Now, forensic examination of the scene, it actually revealed that Brian Sr. never even got up from his armchair. So Blackwell, like I said, just came up behind him, struck him with a claw hammer, executed him. Wouldn't even have known likely what was happening. In fact, his body, when it was looked at, when it was explored, was noted that he was still holding his spectacles in his hands and he was just sat in the armchair. And there were TV listings still up on the television. So he was just, you know, thinking about what programme he was going to watch. And ultimately, that was the last thing that he ever saw before a claw hammer went through his head, through his skull. Brian Sr. had sustained several blows to the head. He also had 30 stab wounds, over 30, in fact. That just makes you think about overkill. Somebody who's just venting, angry, stabbing again and again and again and again. It's not about killing, it's about destruction. It's not about murder, it's about the rageful intent of venting these feelings that this person has hoarded and just can't stop once they start. And immediately when you're an investigator and you see that level of overkill, you think intimate. Can't help it. If somebody's come to burgle you and they're going to steal stuff from your home and it happens to be an unfortunate circumstance where you decide that you want to take them out because they're a witness, you're not going to kill them in this way. You might shoot them, you might stab them, might hit them around the head, but stabbing them over 30 times and several blows to the head, it speaks of something intimate and they're going to know that. Jacqueline, she had several blows to the head. She also had over 20 stab wounds and her body had actually been dragged to the bathroom and was just left on the bathroom floor lying face down. I imagine that speaks of a reaction after killing her where it's like, I don't want to see you. So maybe ultimately for Blackwell, the killing of the mother, it provoked something in him. As opposed to the father, where I think that probably he felt in that moment entitled, there was something about killing her that was less easy. And dragging her to the bathroom, getting her out of the way before he thinks about what to do next, that was important for him. Now, the police immediately went to locate Blackwell because they've got to tell him, your parents are dead. Eventually, they managed to track him down to Amal's house and two detectives were sent there to say, listen, we're very sorry. We've unfortunately found your parents' bodies. They said he was literally overcome with emotion. He actually was sobbing, devastated, and it felt very contextual. That's what the officers said. They said it wasn't out of the ordinary. It was an expected reaction. And he said at one point, it's not physically possible that I killed them. I was on a holiday. He said, I telephoned EasyJet and they're back on the 7th of September. I even spoke to one of the neighbors who told me they were on holiday. So he's trying automatically to be like, I didn't do it. Look, I can tell you why I didn't do it. I've got all this evidence that says I didn't do it. They're on holiday. I've been on holiday. It couldn't have been me. But then, even though they said that was a very contextual reaction, after a silence, he said, is prison cold? So everything felt normal until that entirely out of context statement, is prison cold? And that's because even though he's trying to get away with it, ultimately within him, there is this acknowledgement that this is reality. And there's a strong likelihood that the only line of fire, the only direction, the only place those crosshairs of the law are going is directly on him. So is prison cold? You won't be surprised to know that it took a very short amount of time for the police to arrest him, and that happened on the 8th of September 2004. They arrested him at Amal's house, took him into custody for interrogation. Now, DCI Keogh, who was in charge of the investigation, they said, just question him without interrupting. Ask him for a detailed timeline of what he was doing, where he was. And it's really powerful that to keep asking people, because often they trip themselves up, they additionalize information. It's quite difficult when you're trying to think on your feet to keep everything in line. The truth is always there. Don't get me wrong. When we tell the truth, sometimes we remember other things. A memory is only ever a memory of a memory of a memory. So when we experience something, it becomes a memory. And then every time we recall it, we're memorizing the memory, not the experience. So understandably, we can embellish things at time. And also things can crop up and crop in that we hadn't thought about before. And it's not hard to return to it and revisit it because it's core and it's real. But if you're trying to make things up, that can be very challenging to keep sticking to it when you're being questioned constantly. And when these seasoned investigators who are interrogating you, who are trained in this way, are making you go back again and again to the specifics, that is a lie that doesn't feel very easy to drag back because it's not based in that core memory. And what the officers said was that he started to get more confident, he started to get more assertive in his claims, and they said there was almost a patronising level to the way he was treating them. He was quite dismissive to the officers questioning him, so that ego is coming in, that fantasist is there again. Oh, I can take these men on, I can get away with murder. And it was very clear to them that that wasn't what you'd expect when you're being questioned for the potential murders of your parents. I mean, most of us psychologically, emotionally would be absolutely devastated that these people could for a moment conceive that we had taken a claw hammer and a knife to our own parents. You would be devastated, and you certainly wouldn't be superior and arrogant. That's the last thing that you would be close to in such a circumstance if we were being in contextual with our emotions. So while Blackwell's being interviewed, police at this point ask Amal's family whether they could search her house because clearly he's been there. Now, in particular, they were interested in the garage. And the reason they're interested in the garage is they suspect if he's hiding something, it's going to be in the garage. And indeed, they come across a hold-all bag, and that bag belongs to Blackwell, and it contains a hammer and also keys to his parents' house. Bearing in mind, he spun the yarn that he hasn't been able to go to his parents' house because he hasn't got keys. But lo and behold, there they are. He put that bag in the garage. He knows what's in there. So he's willingly stayed away from the house. There is intent there. He didn't want to go home because he didn't want to be the person discovering his parents' corpses. Now, shortly after them discovering that bag, Blackwell's solicitor tells him, listen, the police have found your house keys. And at that point, he knows he doesn't really have anywhere to go. He's banged to rights and he ends up sobbing and confessing what he did. He said basically it was a split second thing, and he even said, I just couldn't believe what I'd done. So suddenly reality has crashed in and he has to confront the fact that he's now absolutely guilty of killing his parents. Amal's gonna know, her parents are gonna know, the whole community's gonna know. This straight A student, this young man with the future absolutely set because of his incredible intelligence, just disintegrates on the spot because of his selfish desires. And ultimately, even though he's saying it was just a moment of madness, well, there was a lot. A moment of madness is instantaneous. It's a moment. It's not a moment that you repeat as you hit your parents again and again and again and again and again and again with a claw hammer, and you stab them again and again and again, 30 more times than 20 times where your mother's concerned. It's not a moment of madness, that's minutes of absolutely executing and desecrating their bodies. It's about rage, and it's about being found out and feeling enraged that suddenly you're going to have to acknowledge that all the lies you have been telling have indeed been a fantasy constructed purely to impress a girl who potentially would have loved you anyway. And now you're left without parents, you're left without reputation, you're left without a future in medicine. All of that becomes a reality. But of course, he's not finished, is he? Because he's got to think about how to make this situation more palatable. So he starts constructing a story. He said that on the 25th of July, 2004, he was basically putting up posters in his room using a hammer. Now, I know what you're thinking. That seems completely logical, Emma. I mean, it does, doesn't it? I mean, I was a child of the 80s and I can recollect when I had particular individuals that I liked in the 80s and 90s that were in bands. I might go out, get a copy of Smash Hits, get out the free poster in the middle, and then I'd be like, you know, what do I need to do with this? What could I use? Blue Tack? Well, I don't know. Blue Tack seems a little bit, I don't know, 1960s. Sellotape? Sellotape's okay, but it can be those little nasty marks in the wall, and also it reflects. I could use nails. I mean, I'm a teenager. If I'm not nailing my Motley Crue poster to the wall or my John Bon Jovi picture with his fabulous hair on the wall with nails, I don't know what I'm doing. I mean, come on. You don't put posters up with nails. You don't put them up with a claw hammer. You just use a little bit of sticky tape, sticky back paper, blue tack, whatever you fancy. You don't use a hammer. But this is what he's saying. This is why he's got the hammer in his hand now, you know, because you've got to have that. Otherwise, it's huge premeditation, isn't it? If you actually purposefully picked up a hammer and went with the intention of killing your parents, it's different. Moment of madness. Had this in my hand. Then I went crazy. He then admitted to all the financial matters because he had to, because it's clear that he was the one responsible, the fact that he'd used his father's credit cards. And he said, listen, what actually happened was I was just, you know, casually nailing posters to my wall. My parents came in, they'd had dinner, they were really drunk. And then, because obviously they were drunk and they'd discovered all of this financial issue with him and were obviously now incensed, there was this argument, and the argument began between Blackwell and Brian Sr. And he said that they then started to shout at him. They said he needed to tell the truth. He needed to tell his girlfriend that all of this was fabricated. It was all lies. And at that point, he apparently had a meltdown. He's confronted with this fantasy life that he's built for himself. And because of that rage, he takes the hammer that he was using to hang up the posters, strikes his father across the head. He said that Brian Sr. then fell backwards. Then his mother, who'd been in the kitchen, she apparently runs into the room. She's got a carving knife with her. And at that point, she sees this boy of hers that she's brought up and loved brutally bludgeoning his own father. And she reacts. So Blackwell had to grapple his mother. He then hits her in the head with a hammer. Then he gets the knife that she's brought into the room and then stabs both of his parents. So basically, if they hadn't taken me on, if they hadn't shouted at me, if they hadn't told me I was a failure, if they hadn't walked in with a knife, this would never have happened. I mean, he's trying to make it more palatable. It's not premeditated. This is all about a moment of losing my mind because I was confronted with reality. And like I said, he's telling a more palatable story because the truth is his father was sat down. He was hit from behind. He was looking at what to watch on TV. That does not speak of a drunk person in a row. He did state that after he had killed his mum, he became really upset. Like I said, that's why he will have dragged her to the bathroom. He said one of the reasons that he did that is he wanted to put water on her face. He felt like he suddenly came to his senses where she was concerned and he wanted to revive her. And he actually said, I couldn't believe somebody could die so easily. Just going to pause for a minute there. This is a guy who was going to study medicine. He just got 4 A's in his A-levels and he's literally stating, I didn't know that she could die so easily. With respect, you stabbed her 20 times. That isn't dying easily. You hit her around the head with a claw hammer. That's a protracted, drawn-out execution of the most grotesque level. You can't believe that somebody could die so easily when you used a range of weapons in the most callous, aggressive, and persistent of ways. Of course, anybody would die in an attack like that. He then said that after he'd killed them apparently so easily, he went back, sat down with his father's body for a while, and he basically had a knife which he was just poking into him. He said that he couldn't believe that the knife would go in so easily. So he's conjuring up this situation where he's just gone in and he's looking at his dad and he's thinking, I just have a bit of a experiment here and see whether this very sharp knife is as the adverts say and can cut through anything. He's, oh yes, it can, 30 odd times. You know, it's terrifying to hear somebody try to minimise the actions that really took place. And in fact, what it does, it maximises the malevolence. It maximises it. It doesn't minimise it at all. He then went on to say he spoke to his father for some time. He told him he loved him. Of course you do. That's why you stabbed him repeatedly so many times and took a claw hammer to his head. If we're not all hoping that we too can have a love like that, I'm just going to throw it out there. I prefer the Amal's treatment than the parents' treatment. You know, if I've got to choose one of those loves, I'm going to go for the, you know, 3 days in the presidential suite, first class kind of situation. But basically, this is what he's saying. He's telling his dad that he loves him. And he just sat across his room looking at his dad's body after taking the knife to him repeatedly. He said that the entire ordeal took around an hour or maybe more. Harrowing. Now, obviously, he's admitted what he's done. So now he's charged with murder. And he's charged in this case, understandably, with two murders of his parents, the people who loved him. Yes, they may have smothered him. Yes, they may have tiger parented, helicopter parented, call it what you will, micromanaged him. But they were the same parents who'd saved up so that he could go to university. They were the same parents who were bragging to neighbours about what an incredible human being he was, going to the tennis club and letting everybody know that he was going to succeed in whatever he did. Yes, they may have been controlling, but that control came from a really positive place. I'm not saying that smothering children is helpful. It certainly can be deeply problematic for some children. But my God, they loved him and they didn't deserve what happened. When it came down to the trial, it took place at Liverpool Crown Court. That happened on the 27th of June, 2005. The judge was Mr. Justice Royce. The prosecution was led by David Steer and the defence was led by Stephen Riordan. Now, the defence, they sought a defence of diminished responsibility. They said he had a personality disorder and they wanted to lessen the charge to manslaughter. Blackwell was indeed examined by 5 psychologists, and both the prosecution and the defence psychologists did actually agree that Blackwell had narcissistic personality disorder. Apparently, this was the first time that that particular defence was used in the UK. Now, Steer, he described Blackwell as this highly abnormal man, adding that a narcissistic personality disorder diagnosis was really unusual for someone of his age. We would expect it to be diagnosed in somebody older. And when you think about narcissistic personality disorder, so you expect somebody to have grandiosity. That means, I think I'm better than you. I think I'm better than everybody. You're really lucky to be around me. And that's why a lot of people who knew him didn't like being around him because of that trait. Then preoccupation with fantasies of success and power. I live in this fantasy world where I exaggerate my accomplishments, where I'm amazing, where everybody thinks I'm fantastic, where I'm really special. And narcissists often feel that there's something really unique about them. Only I can be understood by people equally as brilliant or even more brilliant than me. So I need to surround myself with these really high status people. And I want you to admire me. I want to be considered the center of everything. Shower me with praise. Make sure that I'm the person that is being noted and noticed more than anybody else. I deserve special treatment. They're individuals who also will really struggle to be in relationships where they are not given everything, ultimately at a cost to their partner. They're not really in the long term that interested in another person's needs. It's just feeding their ego. They won't have a very good level of empathy. They don't really care about other people's feelings. They're more much invested in their own. They often feel quite annoyed if other people are successful, and they're always arrogant. They hate being criticised, and if you criticise them, well, there's a very strong possibility things will not end well for you, as is the case where his parents are concerned. Now, one of the things that I would say about narcissism is it's overused in our modern culture. I hear people talk about the fact that they were in a relationship with a narcissist, that they feel that the parents have got narcissistic traits. I get it. Everybody's got narcissistic traits. Everyone has a level of selfishness because we are born to survive. So often we will choose our needs at times over other people's. And that might be something that doesn't sit well with us, but that is a level of selfishness. But when we're talking about true narcissism, and we're not just talking about the use in popular culture when you're talking about a clinically diagnosed personality disorder, it's really, really challenging to be around somebody with it, because the more you overuse it in pop culture, it kind of reduces its impact. But narcissism, when it's actually diagnosed, can be really problematic for anybody who comes into contact with that narcissist. So when you think about the continuum, yes, you have narcissism as a personality disorder here and narcissistic traits at the very beginning, such as somebody who's highly selfish. It's actually very different when you have selfishness versus when you have entire narcissistic personality disorder. It's quite rare. Now, one of the things that it doesn't mean is that the person loves themselves. I would say that it's not that the person who's a narcissist really is in love with themselves, because that comes from the story of narcissists. It's not actually true that people are completely enamored with who they are. In fact, it comes down more to this idealized, grandiose image of themselves. So they've developed this fantasy self to avoid those deep feelings of inferiority and insecurity. And the problem is that when you create that fantasy, it's really hard keeping it up. So you end up having these really dysfunctional attitudes, you have these really dysfunctional behaviours that have to come in to support what you've created and to bat off the possibility of other people seeing through who you really are, if that makes sense. And Brian Blackwell has narcissistic personality disorder. So killing his parents in a rage after being confronted with the lies, the deceit, the theft, that was too much. That crumbled that facade, and it meant that he was suddenly in that moment met with his true self, and he couldn't bear it. And how dare they lift the veil? And in that moment of his parents, or at least his father, doing that, it was too much. And then the monster erupted, and that core of rage, because he isn't actually the person that he's wanting to portray, and suddenly he's having to confront that person, it's just too much. So instead of going within and thinking, wow, I've done something really shameful, I need to work on this, something broken within me, instead it's easier to, in that moment, eradicate the problem which he perceives as his parents. Now, those psychologists that worked with him and gave him that diagnosis, they said there actually wasn't anything that suggested that the murders were indeed premeditated, but were more a reaction to this deeply challenging situation in that moment that he was confronted with those issues. Now, as Steer was prosecuting, he was obviously looking for a motive for the murders, and he said, listen, it's clear that Blackwell's parents discovered that he was going to go on holiday to America with Mal. They wanted to stop him. This would have made him so angry that it would just driven him to murder, because there was no evidence to say that Blackwell's parents were anything other than loving and supportive towards him. So it was only this that really stood out as the reasoning behind why he went ahead and did that. Now, he actually wrote a letter, which was read out in court, and it said, for every moment of every day, I wish I could turn back the hands of time. I eternally long to be a little boy again, at a time when everyone really loved each other, when we could have a happy time and be a family once more. I miss them more than anything in the world. The guilt will punish and haunt me for 24 hours a day for the rest of my life. It's interesting that he wants to go back to the child state, because child state is when you're in a loving home, a time of no responsibility. It's a time of naivety, it's a time of innocence, it's a time of forgiveness where people accept that you make mistakes. It's a time of less requiring to fit the state that society expects you to fit, the shape that society expects you to fit. And even as a gifted child, those painful responsibilities that come with academic prowess, the expectations of others, they're not as heavy a burden on you. So I can connect with him when he's looking at a time gone by when it was likely enough that he was just a child and was loved for just being that child, where the problems with peers and relationships and all the things that interferes with that really came to fruition. He wants to return to that state where his parents were alive. He hadn't become the monster in the moment or the moments that led to this crime and that ultimately made him an orphan, because he has absolutely made himself an orphan. Now, in his defence, Riordan suggested that he had adapted very well to prison. He was apparently a very well-liked member of the library, and he was a model prisoner, but he's going to be, isn't he? Because his behaviour before this was fantasy-based. He wasn't going about engaged in horrendous criminal acts apart from the fraud. It's not his MO to be a terribly behaved human being, and he's also going to be manipulative to a degree because he's going to want to get out. And the sooner you can get out, the better as far as he's concerned. Now, Blackwell pleaded guilty to manslaughter with diminished responsibility. And on the 29th of June 2005, Judge Royce actually sentenced him to life imprisonment with a minimum term of 12 years. The judge actually added that, in his opinion, Blackwell would never be fit for release. He said that Blackwell was guilty of breathtaking callousness in just leaving his parents' bodies to just rot in the house. He called him an arch deceiver, a resourceful liar, and a wholly manipulative young man. Speaking outside the court, the person who led the case, DCI Keogh, stated that officers could not begin to imagine the distress and pain that these terrible deaths have caused. And they went on to say that throughout the investigation, they'd found almost, quote, overwhelming evidence of two caring parents who doted on their son Brian and had ambitions only for him to fulfill his undoubted potential. Now, interestingly, and I don't know how any of you are going to feel about this, as a result of a parole board hearing in 2016, Blackwell was released. So, Blackwell is now walking the streets again. It's a strange thing to say, isn't it, at the end of one of my videos, because we talked about two people, two loving parents who did nothing wrong, literally losing their lives in the most hideous of fashions, and he's walked free. So the idea the judge had about that individual never being safe to walk the streets again, that wasn't something the parole board ultimately believed. And they gave him his freedom. And when you consider what happens in other countries, like in America, we all know he would never have walked the streets again. He would have been imprisoned for the rest of his natural life. It's as simple as that. And yet, for whatever reason, good behaviour, seemingly being a distinct prisoner from others in prison, they've let him go. Now, I don't know. Maybe he's changed his ways, but somebody with narcissistic personality disorder tends not to be an individual who has the insight to do so. But one could argue, well, maybe his brain hadn't fully developed. Maybe they were a little too quick to say he was a narcissist at such a young age. Maybe over the time that he's had in prison, he's corrected the error of his ways. His conscience has been pricked by the pain he caused those he was meant to love, and he has indeed reformed. And I get it. I get that in the UK, we believe in a healing system, one that can reform. Equally, it's not a very long time to have to disguise who you truly are. Just for the sake of balance, it's always worth acknowledging that if somebody is truly narcissistic, if somebody is truly capable of murdering people who love them, then there's always the possibility that given the right circumstances, the right situation, the right stresses, well, they may just kill again. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.